Hello and welcome to the Ask Weldon Show, episode 283. My name is Weldon Green, and today's episode is on WoW cutting-edge raid UI distractions, losing momentum, and ADHD athletes. And this is from the perspective of myself as a professional sports psychology trainer and esport psychology trainer, and as of about a year and a half ago, or a year ago, a doctoral researcher in health behavior change. So health behavior change is kind of like a, well, leaving off the health part, behavior change is like a kind of a new field that has become an amalgamation or a push together of these fields of research on habit and human behavior change in exercise psychology, sports psychology, and traditional psychology. And I think that it's kind of popping up in more and more departments, and in my university, specifically the sports department, under the category of health behavior change. Although it's looking at other types of behavior change, for example, how is it that you stop people from driving into floodwaters in Australia is a really good example of a research article that I recently read within this field. So they're looking at how it is that you change people's behavior, both on the individual level as well as, you know, on the population scale and mass, things like that. So this podcast is a Q&A show. You call in your questions and I answer them today. I have three questions recorded. We can jump into them. But if you want to call in your questions, please check out the show on Spotify, Mind Games Weldon. Or you can just use the old URL, anchor.fm, anchor like the boat anchor, .fm/mindgamesweldon. You can go there on your phone, and you can also go there in the, I believe in the Spotify app, Mind Games Weldon, and you can call in your question there using the browser on your phone or the browser on your computer. And it takes essentially a pretty good audio sample of your voice. So when you do call in, you can expect that it'll have this radio-esque quality because they do a little tuning of it for you. But of course, if you don't want to be on camera with your voice, you can submit your question via text. Just DM me on Discord or on Twitter, and we'll try to get it in the show. Without further ado, let's jump into it. Okay, the first question is from Dawn.
Hi, Weldon. I retired from the military about 10 years ago and started playing WoW. By the way, I loved your podcast with Max. I've raided at the cutting.
Yeah, so I interviewed the guild of one of the guild leader slash raid leader of one of the World First guilds that raids in the Raid for World First a year or so ago. You can find that on my YouTube channel. His name is Maximum, and he out-of-game leads and used to previously in-game lead one of the Team Liquid's raid team.
Cutting edge level, but to get there, I had to just strip all the graphics off, go to mostly verbal. Without doing that, it was overloading me, my processing, I couldn't prioritize. Now I'm running into similar problems with apps, with web pages, even textbooks, the bolds, the boxes, the colors. And I kind of, in hindsight, feel I may have shortchanged the chance to learn, to adapt to where society is going, which to me is like this hyper-visualization world. My question is, which is better? Adapt your environment to you if you can, or learn to adapt to your environment, or some combo, and how would I go about adapting myself and WoW? Thanks.
So this is a similar question to the kind of age-old question of should I listen to music while I'm studying or doing other tasks, or should I multitask? So I'll break it apart because I think that the question is very directly like, in the Zoomer age, should I have my UI like crazy all over my screen with extra information or not? But I'm going to try to generalize the question, and that is, should I have extraneous information that I'm trying to also have ready and processing, or should I try to trim my environment to keep it pruned down? Or does that kind of handicap me by getting me used to having a trimmed out environment and having a minimalist environment? Unfortunately, this is a kind of both things answer. So first of all, you're only going to focus on the things that you need to focus on. So if you have a bunch of stuff on your UI for your game, or you have a bunch of different tasks in front of you, and you have music playing and you have dishes, you know, kids screaming in the background for dinner and things like that, but you are perfectly focused. Let's say you have the skill of 100% focus, or you happen to be in the zone, then you're you're going to be deploying 100% of your focus on the thing that you're going to be focusing on, and all the rest of the stuff, whether it's there or not, is going to be pretty irrelevant in that moment of focus. So I think the question is, how often do those things kind of pull you out of your focus when you need to be otherwise focusing, i.e. like how ADHD is your focus? And that kind of depends on your training. So if you find it very easy to just zone in and hammer in on a single thing, and it kind of doesn't matter if there's other stuff going on, then you don't need to worry so much about that. Or if you, let's say you're ADHD and you take a medication for it, then you probably don't need to trim your environment as much. Let's say that you meditate a lot and you want to practice that kind of application, like a live application of that refocusing skill, so you don't mind having the distractions there because you can refocus yourself back to the kind of like the most important information, then you can keep the environment whatever it is naturally full of. You don't have to try to trim it down. Now, as far as performance goes, I like to think of in-game UIs in pretty much any game as kind of a heads-up display for a fighter pilot. So as a sports psychology trainer, I try to think of as many kind of similarities or equates to esport athletes as I can in real-world scenarios, so that when I go look for research, I can say like, well, this research article is researching fighter pilots or researching hockey players, but these principles will apply or generalize to my population of athletes because XYZ. And so a lot of the research that I have devised trainings from or insight from is on shooters, that is people who are shooting like actual guns and bows and arrows for sport, not FPS shooters, and then also pilots. And these are two populations that use like massing together a bunch of information, following strict protocols, you know, fine motor movements and performance under pressure and under stress. And so if you think about in terms of fighter pilots, you want your heads up display to have just the information that you need, but you need to be able to get any information that you could need, you know, at a moment's notice, either from your instrument panel or from calling it up or from putting it on your HUD or from it popping up and then disappearing. So as I recommend, as a performer, you should have a totally trimmed heads-up display that provides the information that you need when you need it and eliminates duplicate information and unnecessary information. Just from a pure performance perspective, like that is what is the best. Now, whether or not that conditions you to, unfortunately, being desensitized to having these very busy environments that exist nowadays, I think that's true. Sensitization training is a part of a lot of sports psychology training protocols. So I think that let's say you're going to be performing on stage with a bunch of people screaming and cheering. Well, maybe you want to pipe in cheering and screaming and distracting sound and music to your headphones so that you get used to that. That's literally what we did on some of the pro teams I worked on when we were trying to get them ready for stage. You know, we would pipe in the white noise, we'd pipe in the crowd noise, you know, we'd pipe in cheering, we'd even like talk to them during the game to get them used to that, kind of like zoning us out if they would hear the announcers in the background, stuff like that. So I think that you can do that sensitization training. However, I'm not sure that you need to do it all the time. I think that you could just do it before a big performance for, you know, two or three sessions or 1 or 2 weeks. It's very similar to, this is a totally different realm, but in competitive swimming, we don't do CO2 training, CO2 tolerance training all the time. So you know, when you're underwater and you feel like you have to come up and breathe, most of the time it isn't lack of oxygen that's forcing that reflex. It's the CO2 poisoning, like the rising CO2 level in your blood that's saying like, get out of the water and breathe, like take a breath. So that's kind of the thing that you do before a big meet or a big competition is you spend about 10 to 14 days raising your tolerance for CO2 in the blood by forcing yourself to hold your breath underwater for longer and longer periods under effort. And And that training doesn't hold. It doesn't stick. It's not like muscular training where you build stronger muscles and you keep them for a while. It just disappears the moment you stop doing it. So it's probably similar with this distraction training from what I can glean from my experience. I don't think there's any research on this really, but I can tell you that this kind of training goes away immediately. You adapt to like a completely new environment. So I would say prepare for a big event with this style, and otherwise trim your living and performance life environment to necessary information and to be as peaceful as possible. Now, this doesn't apply to, for example, my wife and I were living a very minimalist life when we moved to Finland. I mean, we had like white walls, very limited furniture, you know, very few possessions, and then we had a baby. It's literally proven through research that babies without toys develop develop less well than kids with a lot of toys, you know. So you can't apply these kinds of principles of having this low distraction life to every single stage of development. You know, you can't apply it to people who are in the womb or 0 to 3, 0 to 5 years old. These people need a lot of stimulation, and it seems like the more the better, as long as it's good stimulation. It doesn't seem like it is a bad thing to be overstimulated at that age when the brain is just figuring everything out. So, you know, apply these things to the adult world and don't extrapolate them down to every level of development, and don't extrapolate them to other populations. If you're neurotypical or not neurotypical, this could be very different rules. So that's the answer to that question. Sorry it was long and involved. It's the first podcast back, so expect, and I've been doing my PhD for a year and a half, so expect overly verbose and probably way too academic answers to these. I'll get back to the snappier, more effective sports psychology trainer advice, probably the more that I do it, get back into it here. So let's go on to question number two from BJ about Super Smash Brothers, actually.
Hey there, Weldon. Hope you're doing well. Today, I have a question about Super Smash Brothers and I guess fighting games in general. My friend was having an issue with when he's playing against his opponent, sometimes he'll feel overwhelmed, or he used the term outpaced by sort of the speed and the decision-making that his opponent is using. So my question to you is, how would you deal with somebody that's just making decisions way faster than you are? Would the answer be to somehow increase your level of decision-making to sort of match pace with anyone you may come up against? Or would it be better to find a way to slow down your opponent and bring the pace back to somewhere you're more comfortable with? Or some third thing that you may know that I don't know, but I'm trying to decide between those two, and how would you approach it?
All right, BJ, thanks for the question. So there's really two questions I have to answer in here. One is about momentum and pacing in competitive sports, and the other one is about decision-making speed, and kind of a skill differential question. So let's deal with the momentum and the pacing one first. Momentum is like one of those things that's not a thing, but it's actually a thing. It's researched, but it's hard to find. And it's one of the things where like there's solutions that work, but they're all individual. So it's very similar to the concept of lucky underwear. Lucky underwear is proven to work for basketball free throw shooting, at least. It's also been duplicated in other sports, but the most famous paper is the one about basketball free throw shooting, where lucky underwear was proven to be an additive to skill, but only if you believed in it. If you didn't believe in it, it didn't work. If you did believe in it, it did work. So it's one of those things where it's like, actually, it's in the brain. It's not the underwear itself. So momentum is one of those things where like when you are... You need to think of momentum with reference only to yourself or to your opponent, right? So if your opponent does not believe in momentum and doesn't feel it in any way, then you can't disrupt their momentum because it's a purely psychological construct. And if you don't believe in momentum and don't really feel momentum, kind of, then it's not going to affect you. And so you can train yourself not to believe in momentum and not to think of it that way, although it's very hard because it's kind of like a natural state of panic, as you might notice as you're losing, and as you're winning you get lazier. But you can also just try to adopt a more present moment performance mindset. So I had players who were really experienced players and were very accustomed to losing from any situation, way far ahead in the match and then lose, and way far behind and then win, right? So this is a quality of experience. And when you have that knowledge, your momentum doesn't affect the momentum that should be there doesn't affect you as much. So let me start by breaking it apart into pieces. There's four different phases of momentum that you need to be concerned with for yourself. You're really far behind, or you're right behind, or you're right ahead, or you're really far ahead. Okay? So if you're really far behind, people generally lose hope and get sloppy instead of realizing that they need to play more than perfect to catch up, right? Also, if they're super far behind and they're trying to play more than perfect to catch up, sometimes they'll freeze up and they'll choke on that kind of pressure. And so you got to recognize that you need to keep loose in your reactions and not overthink things. And at the same time, you need to take it very seriously that you're trying to catch up and not make silly errors. Okay. And then there's the really far ahead where people get sloppy because they're lazy, because they think they're just going to win and they can make more mistakes. And for that, you just need to make sure that you're constantly refocusing on the game and recommitting to not playing not to lose, but rather continuing to be aggressive and play to win the way that you would if you were neck and neck, okay? So playing not to lose is something that people who are really far ahead, they're like, oh my gosh, if I lose now, it looks really bad. So I just have to make sure not to make any mistakes. It's kind of like a bad mindset. All right, then you have the momentum of being right in front or right behind. And these are kind of the best places to perform at. You're neck and neck and you're just ahead and you're feeling super competent and you're like, I got to keep this lead. You know, when you're trying really hard and being right behind, these are the two kind of high performance zones that are close to neck and neck. And so that's where you want to be, or that's if you were in one of the outer zones, such as really far behind or really far ahead, you want to push yourself, fake it till you make it by pushing yourself towards one of the other two. Like, believe that you're right behind and you can just catch up, or believe that the other person is breathing down your neck. And then you might act like the other person is breathing down your neck. So you can kind of use momentum coding in your brain to manipulate yourself by telling yourself that that's the actual scenario. Okay, so That's momentum in a nutshell. And then your opponent supposedly has that too. So you can kind of play into that. By if they're really far ahead, you can expect them to make more mistakes. And if they're really far behind, you can expect them to give up more easily and feel more pressured when they're trying to be error-free. If you play a game that has very few forced errors, such as... I'll give you an example with... let's say League of Legends is a video game where... There are, no. World of Warcraft's a perfect example. There's almost no forest errors in World of Warcraft. Forest errors from the boss, like the boss does the same thing every single pull. It's like learning a dance, a ballroom dance that you memorize every step, right? So almost every error is an unforced error. It's like one that you do. It's not one that another human goes and makes an unpredictable move, and then all of a sudden you have a forced error because, you know, they forced you to guess wrong or to have to manipulate a skill that you weren't prepared to do or that you messed up the execution of. So if you're playing a game like that that has very few forced errors, then you're not really relying on momentum with the opponent in play, and you can't really affect their momentum. You can kind of only affect your own unforced error rate, and that's done through focus, through keeping your eye on the prize. But in Smash Brothers, your example, lots of forced errors to be had and lots of unforced errors to be made. And so you can look to force errors on people by continuing to be super, super aggressive. For example, if they're trying to make them, if they're trying to play perfectly from behind and not make a single other mistake, you know, you can put them in a position to make a bajillion more mistakes by trying to force their hand being more aggressive. So yeah, you can play into momentum that way. There's a whole bunch of little quips and rules for each phase of momentum on what you should do to yourself and what you should do to your opponent. And I have that list and I can put it in my Discord. So if you go below this video or you search for the Mind Games Discord or Mind Games Weldon Discord, probably you can find the link somewhere. And then I will put it in what channel should I put it in? Maybe the Ask Weldon Show? Yeah, I'll put it in the Ask Weldon Show and I will reference this episode. Okay. So there you go. I got to back to the navigation here. Okay, so the second thing that you mentioned was Help me out here. I kind of forgot in the question. Oh, yeah, decision speed. Okay, you don't make decisions faster or slower than somebody. Well, you do a little bit, as in, like, they might have a better diet than you, and so they have healthier glial cells in their brain, and so their processing is milliseconds faster than you. But that's not really relevant. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about, like, when somebody hits your knee and your reflex speed is nanosecond faster. What you're talking about is, you know, decision-making in performance situations and executing a pre-prepared motor skill in response to stimulus. And the reason that some things seem faster or slower is that, first of all, you have to understand what is a sport skill. So a sport skill, as I like to say it, is essentially a sports movement. Everything in sport requires a movement. It's a motor connection, okay? So if you're talking about something like chess, I don't consider that a sport. It doesn't mean that sports psychology principles don't apply, but this basic movement, which is the sport movement, which is your eyes see a pattern. The pattern is recognized, or your ears, your eyes, your sensory input puts together a pattern. The pattern is recognized by your brain because of a vast volume of training and conditioning. You pull that pattern out, you apply the meaning programming to it. You have a response in your motor cortex, and the response is an automatic execution of a skill that you, again, have trained a lot. So it's either a click or moving your arm or positioning the mouse or some sort of regulated and controlled coordinated movement. You know, like a ball is coming towards you and you put that other pattern and you plan to hit it. A good example of why I say pattern and not reaction is that a good example occurs in baseball. So you don't actually see the ball and try to hit the ball in baseball. You see a shape of a throw. You see the ball when it's like leaving the pitcher's hand, and that's the last that you see the ball before you hit it. It flies too fast through the air for the optics to be processed and for you to get the movement to your motor neurons. So you're essentially putting together this pattern of meaning, interpreting it, predicting where the ball is going to be using your vast experience and training, and then executing like a coordinated motor movement to hit the ball at a certain spot. And if it's there and your bat meets it, great. So you just did a baseball skill, right? So this is why I say that this is a pattern recognition game, not a like reaction game. You're not looking at things and reacting to them. So essentially what I could say is that your friend is playing a person who has, they aren't making decisions faster. They have more elements incorporated into their pattern than your friend does. So instead of trying to see what move they're doing and reacting, they're able to kind of see what move the other person's doing and reacting, thinking three moves ahead, also planning the strategy overall, also thinking of their, you know, their momentum and your opponent's momentum. And they already are doing all of that before they're even thinking about it, because they've stretched themselves, they've pushed themselves to have to incorporate this information into the whole play. And you can train this. In fact, some people spend their entire sport life or their entire video game life at a very low level because they never try to push themselves into incorporating more information into their decision-making process. Going back to the first question of the show with Dawn, if you play World of Warcraft and you repeatedly do the same thing every single pull and you never try to incorporate more and more complex decisions, then you're just going to be learning a ballroom dance every single time, and you're going to be stuck with the skills that you developed to learn the first ballroom dance. You're never going to become a better and better dancer. Whereas if you're constantly saying like, okay, I'm going to ballroom dance while holding a teacup full of tea in one hand. Okay, I'm going to ballroom dance, but I'm also going to like balance a plate on my head at the same time. You're kind of like challenging yourself with these more and more complex patterns. And then that pushes you to be able to incorporate more things in your decision-making. You can decide which step you're supposed to take next in the dance while also knowing exactly how to balance the teacup and the spinning plate on your head. Maybe the teacup should be on your head and the spinning plate should be in your hand. I think that would be a lot easier. Anyway, going back to the Smash example, actually, I do this more in FPS training. So I train this a lot more in League of Legends and in FPS, but I'll try to extrapolate this to Super Smash Brothers. I would say that your friend should take a skill that he usually is not considering. So for example, he should be trying to plan what he's going to do next or what his opponent's going to do next while still reacting to and countering the thing that the opponent is doing now. Or he should intentionally be... I don't know if this is a good parallel, but in ping pong, you get to a level where you're returning people's ping pong serves and balls like pretty well, and you're getting into a volley okay, but you're not thinking yet about what you want to do with the ball yourself, like where you want to send it, if you want to try to send it at an angle or always put it on the right side or left side or which, you know, hand you want to hit it to. And once people start thinking about that, they usually mess up. They're just like, okay, I'm going to hit it to their left hand, to their backhand, because they have a weak backhand. And then they miss. And they're like, ugh, I'm trying too hard. I should just try to return it. I shouldn't try to aim it also. That's the wrong instinct. So anytime that your friend is playing and they're like, ugh, I need to focus on just this one skill, no. Tell him that he needs to, or she needs to, try to do the same execution skill and also focus on the additional skill that they want to kind of layer onto their decision. And what they'll do is they'll build up a larger pattern that eventually, through lots of play and training, will start to become fluid and possible when before it was not possible. And that's how you speed up your decision-making in sport. You don't get faster by like narrowing things down. You get faster by building up more and more complex patterns of stimulus that you're able to incorporate into your kind of reflex response and knowing what to do in that situation. Because it has to be pretty automatic to be fast enough for sport. So I hope that answers the question. Again, getting very involved here. Hopefully I'm able to trim it down in future shows. But let's jump on to the third question from one of our staple questioners, Ryan.
Hey, Weldon. When working with athletes who have ADHD, is there anything that you do differently than you would with athletes who don't have ADHD? And then I guess, what are the similarities between the two? I imagine there's a lot of overlap and some differences.
Yes. And before I answer that, I wanted to say to remember that I also do the show live and that you can check that out on Twitch and YouTube. Since Twitch has allowed like co-streaming, I'm going to give it a shot and try to stream it on YouTube as well. And I'm having people who are chatting me right now, and after the show, I'm going to answer their questions and their follow-up questions and kind of chat with them. So if you want to check out this show live, this is the recorded video portion that I'm recording right now, but I am live to those of you in chat. Hello. You can go to my Twitch, twitch.com/mindgamesweldon, or YouTube where you're watching it here, mindgamesweldon. You can follow along or turn on some sort of notification that tells you when I go live. I'm going to try two different times this year for this show. I'm going to try in the morning in California, and also I'm going to try in the evening in California, and we will see how that works. I'm situated in mainland Europe, so in Finland right now. And so time zones for me are going to be really early in Finland or really, really late in Finland, kind of like after the kids go to bed. So that's when we're going to give it a shot. And I have to point out also that you can submit a question for the show on anchor.fm/mindgamesweldon. It's probably the easiest way to do that. And yeah, okay, that's better set up there. And you can check out the Mind Games program at my Patreon, patreon.com/mindgamesweldon, which is kind of like, I guess, how I'm going to be supporting the show this runaround. But I'm working on getting the website back up, mindgames.gg, and in the meanwhile, I'm going to be hosting everything on Patreon and on Vimeo, and you can check it out there either as a Twitch subscriber or a YouTube subscriber or a Patreon subscriber. Or if you were a previous purchaser of the program, you can message me and you can get a copy of the program. It's a 47-video course online training in mindfulness, acceptance, and commitment, which are the kind of like essential skills for stepping into sports psychology training for your specific sport, and is geared toward esport, but it works for performance domains across traditional sport as well. And even for people who are doing, you know, hobbyist stuff and general life skills. Want to be a better cook, want to be a better husband, better father, things like that. I have found all of these things very, very useful for those kinds of pursuits as well. So once again, Please submit questions for the show so that I can continue it now. I'm using up my 3 questions that I stored over this long break. And since I want to kick it off as a regular show, I'm going to have to fill in content until I get more questions. So you can call in your question at anchor.fm/mindgamesweldon or on the Spotify version of that page. I think they're forwarding the URL now since Spotify bought this podcasting platform. And check out patreon.com/mindgamesweldon or subscribe on YouTube or Twitch to get access to the Mind Games program, which is my old training program, launched in 2015 and has happily helped over 3,000 people who've participated in it. Although I noticed that when I got up to like the 20th day of the program, there were only about 1,200 views on the videos. So I think that about a half or a third of the people who were interested in it progressed past the second week. So I did notice that. I'll have to check that out, see what's going on. But it's kind of like one of the things that you get when you don't run a live classroom. When I was a professor, I could handhold and guide every single one of my students like through the course and guarantee that all of them pass. But doing an online automated video course, it's kind of like people have to come with their own inbuilt motivation and habits in order to kind of like pursue it all the way through. And it's a rather long and intensive program, although I tried to layer as much value into the beginning as possible. And maybe that suited the people who were suited by it. So again, back to the original question from Ryan. ADHD and coaching. Do I accommodate ADHD? So first of all, in the sports psychology world, there are people who are trained for sports psychology training, and there are people who are trained for clinical psychology who then go off into sport. So it kind of works like this. You're a sport coach, you become interested in psychology of performance, and you go and you get a degree, and you become a sports psychology trainer with a background in sports coaching. And then there are people who are clinical psychologists or psychiatrists, and they become interested in sport or were interested in sport, and they leave the clinical world and they start dealing with healthy populations, that is athletes. And so although sports psychology trainers are decently good at diagnosing some of these diseases, because any program that's worth its salt will cover the DSM manual and the various different ways of recognizing depression, ADHD, and eating disorders, because these are the most common things that you kind of run into immediately in sport. What we're trained to do is immediately recommend them. So we're going to make sure that we recommend them to a clinical psychologist or a clinical therapist or a clinical psychiatrist to get treated. And then as far as how it is that training is accommodated, it's so individual and so personal. So I don't think that there's like a general way that you say like all ADHD people need this, because it depends like how is their treatment going? Are they using a kind of like ADHD drug? And I think that we're not. And I think that generally speaking, my adaptations for all of my training have been to the individual and not to the disorder, if that makes sense. Or rather, not to whatever it is that is defining them as a neurotypical, but rather to the person and accommodating kind of like what they need and what motivates them. Because a lot of the fundamental wiring of motivation and behavior change still functions with neurotypical situations like OCD, ADHD, and depression. It's just that there's a lens through which the brain is taking in information and able to put out behaviors. And since I am not the person who is supposed to be dealing with that, I try to make sure to not cross that line into the clinical practice in how it is that I'm recommending to them to deal with it. Always pushing them towards talk therapy or medication if that is what suits them. But definitely I have found from people telling me that, for example, the Mind Games program, which is a mindfulness-based acceptance commitment program built off of mindfulness acceptance commitment therapy and the CBT elements that I use, which are built off of cognitive behavioral therapy, that these kinds of therapized sports psychology training programs work really well with therapy populations, like people who have ADHD or OCD or depression. And so it's kind of like easier for me to deliver interventions with these clinical populations or populations that may or may not be clinical in that way than a traditional life coach or performance guru or whatever, who's just coming at it from the, you know, here's a video course perspective or like kind of a guru perspective, because I have a theory behind the work that I do, and it's all therapy-based theory, and everything that I do is extrapolated from that in kind of the sports psychology world, because that's where we evolved from. And so I have like everybody who works from this sector and is trained have an advantage in that our stuff just works with those populations without any kind of thought of need of adaptation, because that's originally what it was for anyway. So I don't do particularly any adaptation to the disorder, but rather I do it for the person that I'm working with. All right, that's the show for today. Again, thank you for tuning in. I'm going to go now to the live audience and chat with them for a bit. If you're on YouTube and watching this recording, make sure to check out the show live by following me on one of those channels, or go to my Patreon, patreon.com/mindgamesweldon, and you can find more information there, as well as the Mind Games program that I was talking about. And call in a question now. Everybody who's watching and has a question at this point is still around. It's because you were hanging out so long to see if I was going to answer the deep secret inquiry of your heart. So go to anchor.fm/mindgamesweldon or whatever the podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/mindgames, whatever it is, the new URL for the, they got to simplify that. I mean, that's ridiculous. Find my podcast. Maybe the link is in Discord. I'll just put it under the description of every single video I can find and call in your question, because if I'm going to come and do the show tomorrow, I need at least 3 people to call it in. Get to it.